أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله ومن والاه. Brothers and sisters, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله وبركاته.
I'd like to begin by thanking the organizers of this program. Nothing happens without some effort. So those who put in the effort to make this afternoon possible, you have my gratitude. I also would like to thank everyone who is present here this afternoon, because you took time off from what you would normally be doing and made the effort to be here. So may Allah give you and compensate you for your motivation and your presence. The subject that we are going to cover is under the title Wahhabism. And Wahhabism is a word that has been used quite frequently after 9/11. Before that time, only selected Muslims would care to speak about Wahhabis or Wahhabism. Along with that word, the word Wahhabism is another word that is Salafism. So we have Wahhabis and we have Salafis. And sometimes, actually many times, I've heard Muslims come up to me and say, so what's the difference between a Wahhabi and a Salafi? So these two words sometimes get confused. And I think I'm going to try to, if you can bear with me, I'm going to try to clear the air concerning these two words, at least to a great extent. We can't exhaust this because everything has its exceptions, and sometimes there are what's called moderates and extremists in these two definitions, and but barring that, the word Salafi simply means a person who refers to the ancestors, those who have preceded. Salaf is precede. It came in times that have passed. So the word Salafi has been used to refer to the first and second and third generations that followed after the Prophet. These are called in Islamic wording As-Sahaba, At-Tabi'een, and Tabi'i At-Tabi'een. So, people who call themselves Salafis, generally speaking, are people who would refer an Islamic judgment or an Islamic decision or an Islamic legal opinion or an Islamic fiqh, understanding, to those first generations of Muslims. That is why they are called Salafis. And this type of reference has very quickly some basis to it. The first basis is, of course, being that the Quranic text was present in those years of Islam, they obviously refer themselves to the Quranic text. And then, after that, they would refer themselves to the opinions of the Sahaba. And then after that, if they find that there is a difference between what one Sahabi would say and what another Sahabi would say, they would try to, in their own mind, find the Sahabi's opinion that is closer to what they understand of the Book of Allah and give it more credibility. And if they cannot find a Sahabi's statement that is more credible than the other, they would simply state both or all the statements coming from the Sahaba. They also prefer, please make a note of this, they also prefer a hadith that is da'if, meaning a hadith that has not much credibility to it. They would prefer that to rational judgment. Obviously, they would prefer a hadith da'if to what is called al-qiyas in Islamic jurisprudence. And they consider the Salafis, remember we're still speaking about Salafis here, they consider the first person to have improvised these bases for Salafism to be Ahmad ibn Hanbal. And he is known in his works and in his writings to have, if there is two contradictory or incompatible statements from the Sahaba, to place those side by side and not be judgmental about them. He calls, in his literature, which you can consider to be the founding literature of the Salafis, the word imam that is used, he interprets the word imam to be, or al-imam to be al-kitab. So an imam, in his understanding of things, is the Qur'an. That's the imam. It is also reported that Ahmad ibn Hanbal, who's considered to be the founder of Salafism, so to speak, he is reported to have said, and I quote, "Al-hadithu al-da'ifu ahabbu ilayya min al-ra'i," which means a weak hadith, an unsubstantiated hadith, is more preferable to me than an opinion about a legal matter, meaning man's rational input is less important than a hadith that has no basis. The Salafis, therefore, in their understanding of things, make no room for ijtihad, for ra'i. And we're not speaking about ra'i here that is improvised thought. We are speaking here about ra'i that means rational thought. Because in the history of Islam, the word ra'i has a positive connotation and it has a negative connotation. When I use the word here, al-ra'i, in the Salafi context, it is the rejection of the Salafis of the word ra'i with its positive connotation. So they have no ijtihad, no ra'i, no qiyas, and no ta'weed. None of this figures into their school of thought, so to speak, if we can call it that. At-ta'wil is, for those of you who are familiar with the Arabic text or with Arabic wording, صَرْفُ لَفْظ الْكَلِمَ إِلَى مَعْنًا تَحْتَمِلُهَا, which means that التَّأْوِيل means that you take a word that tolerates a certain meaning and you give the particular word that tolerated meaning. And the Salafis say that this is not something that they agree with. Now, to some of you, this may sound very scholastic and academic and all of this. Okay, let me bring you down to a little historical ingredient. At the time we are speaking about, the second century of Islam. And during the second century of Islam, the Muslims of Arabia had come into contact with what may be called the outside world. And the outside world had philosophies, theologies, science in those days, you know, relatively speaking, something that the Arabian Peninsula did not have. And so what developed in the Muslim context was a rational school of thought, which is referred to as the Mu'tazilis, and a scriptural school of thought, or a literalist scriptural school of thought, which is referred to as the Salafis. Here we have the Muslims finding themselves on a base-to-base, day-to-day contact with the philosophies of India and Persia and Greece and the Byzantines and the Egyptians. They were not in contact with this before. This is the first time they come in contact with people who have opinions about matters. So inside the Muslim body, there was a response to that contact. It was a rational response, as I said, that is represented by the Mu'tazilis. And then there was the literalist response that was represented by the Salafis. They say, the only one who understands, the Salafis say, the only one who understands what Islam is were those first generation of Muslims. So if someone comes to us with an argument about, let's say, whether Allah has a hand or doesn't have a hand, the only way we're going to have to understand this is to go back to those first three generations of Muslims and understand how they understood this. And when we understand what their answer to that question is, it becomes our answer. So that's why you have them, when they come and say, there's an ayah in the Quran that says, يَدُ اللَّهِ فَوْقَ أَيْدِيهِ. Allah's, literally, translating this ayah, it literally means, Allah's hand is above their hand. So you ask these Salafis, these types of people, okay, now what do you understand from this? They say, well, Allah has a hand. And we say, well, excuse me, did I understand you right? You're saying Allah has a hand? I say, yeah, Allah has a hand. And I say, well, can you be more, a hand? I mean, this is a hand. you mean to say Allah has a hand like this? They say, yeah. Okay. Well, here you're giving Allah a figure, are you not? And they will say, well, yeah, he has a figure, we just don't understand how that figure is. And you want to go a step further, you say, وَيَبْقَى وَجْهُ رَبِّكَ ذُو الْجَلَالِ وَالْإِكْرَامِ وَجْهُ رَبِّكَ, the face of your sustainer. What do you understand from that? Allah has a face? Say, yeah, Allah has a face. They say, excuse me. I mean, this is a face. There's eyes, there's ears, there's nose, there's... You mean to say Allah has those types of... He said, yeah, yeah. He said, well, how do you know this? They said, well, this is the way the first three generations, we spoke about the Sahaba, Tabi'in, Tabi'i, that's the way they understood it, so that's the way we understand it. Of course, the rest of the Muslims, besides these Salafis, they didn't understand it like this. They understood this to have what is called an allegorical meaning. It's not a literal meaning. When we say Allah's hand, we're not speaking about a physical hand. We're speaking about the power of Allah, not the physical hand. But they couldn't understand it like that. Now, if you have, I'm just trying to clarify the difference between a Salafi and a Wahhabi. When we take this understanding that reacted, this is a reaction to the development of human thought that was represented at that time by the civilizations that were outside of Arabia. Much of these arguments were fermenting in Iraq. And this reaction here could be understood in different ways. There's the negative understanding of it, which is the literalist. That's what we were speaking about, the Salafi literalists. They take the words in their literal meaning. And that's how they understand it. But then there's the rational understanding of it, that don't understand these words literally. They understand it in a more expanded sense that doesn't conflict with the tolerance of the Quranic language. And these dealt with the recurring mental challenges in a philosophical way, and they served Islam very well at the time. Unfortunately, in the course of history, we don't have time here to outline the clash that took place between what is called the Ash'aris and the Mu'tazila back in the time of the Abbasi dynasty. There was a big polarization in the Muslim world that almost resulted in a civil war that would have torn apart the Muslim social fabric. Suffice it to say here that if we take a leap from that time up until our present time, we have Salafis who are not negative Salafis. We have them in a very positive way, Salafis. Indeed, like Jamaluddin Asad Abadi or Jamaluddin Afghani, he's considered to be a Salafi. Not in the negative sense. He wasn't a literalist Salafi. He was a Salafi in the positive sense. That when there is, because the Muslim world in the time of Jamaluddin Asad Abadi, it was facing almost the same challenge that we are talking about here during the Abbasi time. The Muslim world right now is waking up to European civilization, Western civilization, the Chinese, the Indians, all of these who have a more developed, rational or scientific accomplishment in life, the Muslims right now are waking up to them, just like they were coming in contact with the same type of progressive human thought or scientific accomplishments. So Jamaluddin Asad Abadi or his student Muhammad Abdu or his student Muhammad Rashid Rida or Abdul Hamid bin Badis in Algeria or Abdurrahman al-Kawakibi in Syria, and these are considered to be Salafis. But you have to be careful, like many Muslims are not, that these are not Salafis in the literalist sense of the word. They didn't say, you come and ask them, did Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala have a hand? They're going to tell you, yeah, he had a hand. Okay, could you tell us how that? Oh, it's a hand, just like, do I have to explain to you what a hand is? They weren't that type. They were the rationalist types who were referring to the understanding of the Qur'an in the first generations of Muslims as an open understanding, not a closed and literalist understanding. Okay. Some of this has to do with the Wahhabis that right now I'm going to shift to. Startle you with Wahhabis out of nowhere, because this has a relationship to who the Wahhabis are. Now, who are the Wahhabis? In the year 1702, a person was born in Arabia, in Najd in Arabia. His name was Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab. In the area of called Al-Uyayna or Huraymullah. These are two not far away villages in that remote, deserted, forsaken area of Arabia. And at the time when he was to go to school, he grew up, his father was a scholar, whatever that may have meant in those times. He went to school, and then when he had to go to for his what we call today higher education, he went to Al-Madina, and he went to school there, and he began to realize that, wait a minute, something is wrong here. In his own mind, this is his observations of society at that time. He began to see that there are Sufis who are going to certain awliya. These are something some people would say equivalent to saints, and saying dua at their graves or bringing some food to those graves and eating there or lighting some candles at some of these graves. And he had to say, what is this? And in his mind, he reached the conclusion, this was not a limited occurrence in one isolated area that he came across. This was all over. It was in Al-Hijaz, it was in Al-Madina, it was in... because he also later on went to Al-Basra in Iraq, it was in Al-Basra in Iraq, it was all over. He saw this, and then he reached the conclusion. And remember, at that time, that area was governed by the Ottoman state. And the Ottoman state at that time had encouraged tasawwuf and Sufism for its own purposes. And so when he saw this, he made up his mind that this represents what he called shirk. These people are placing between them and Allah others that don't belong there. This status that these people have towards these others, saints, scholars, Sufis, imams, whatever, he considered this to be a form of shirk. If not the worst form of shirk. Because it is related in some of his statements that he said the shirk of his time, what he is seeing of shirk, is much worse than the shirk that the Prophet himself had to face up to. So now he wanted to do something about it. He had this notion of al-amr bil-ma'roof and al-nahy an al-munkar, that now he has to take action against this shirk. So he goes to the ruler there in that part of Najd, and he convinces him that we're going to have to, you know, use force against this expression of the violation of Allah's divinity and Allah's authority. So he convinced the emir of that area, and then they began going to these places and using force to destroy the tombs or the structures that were set up for devotion, for trying to express a form of tawassul to Allah. No one was deifying these, as far as I could tell from my readings of this, no one was deifying these awliya or these a'imma or these scholars. There was no deification here. But in the mind of Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, that's what he thought people were doing. Now that's not to say there may have been some ignorant people who actually got confused in this. But anyways, when he convinced this emir of this area, and then they began going out and using force to destroy the structures that were there, that were revered by certain people. And he got away with it in that limited area in Najd. And then he goes to Al-Madina. And there is a place for Zayd ibn al-Khattab, in which people used to revere. They used to go there, and no one's worshipping Zayd ibn al-Khattab, but in Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab's mind, you know, these people are wrong. I mean, they're worshipping the wrong God. So he had to do something about that, and he began to destroy this place. And there was a backlash from the people at this time. There was a semi-uprising against Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab. And so his ally, the emir there, said, they threatened him. They said, if you're going to continue with this relationship with this person, we're going to go to war against you. So this person, he realized he's under so much pressure. He said, no, I can't deal with this. I'm giving up on this alliance. I don't want to go along with this any longer. So Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab at this time looks around. He needs some tribe, some power base there in Arabia that would help him out in this pursuit of what he called the mushrikeen and the kuffar. These are Muslims. They may have been ignorant Muslims by no doubt, but these are Muslims. They're not kuffar and mushrikeen. So he comes across Muhammad ibn Sa'ud, the emir called Muhammad ibn Sa'ud, and he opens up his mind on the subject, and they enter into an alliance. This is the nucleus of today's Saudi Arabia. At this point, we have in history the building blocks of today's Saudi Arabia, this alliance between Muhammad ibn Sa'ud and Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab. And they begin this right now multiplier of what was previously a much limited force. Now it's a much bigger force, and they began going all around Arabia, purging Arabia of this shirk, as they called it. And At one point, they see that they've made ways in Najd, in Hijaz, in Tihama, in southern Arabia. They thought they're on a winning spree here. So they go to Karbala. And there they attack Masjid al-Imam al-Hussein. And there was a war. There was a war. I mean, 2,000 Karbala'is were killed. And the destruction that they did, at that time the masjid had a decoration of precious metal to it. There was gold, there were gemstones, there were these things. And to Ibn Abd al-Wahhab, this was anathema. This was, you know, look how far they have gone in idolizing, in his own mind, idolizing Imam al-Hussein. So, the Ottoman state that was ruling in that part of the world, it realized this person has really gone too far. So what they do is, there was a ruler, his name is Muhammad Ali Pasha in Egypt. They told him, you know, go and take care of this guy. So he sends in an army, his son Ibrahim Pasha, and there was a war between these two sides. And the combination of the Saudi Wahhabi forces lost in this war. They didn't lose in the sense that they gave up. They lost a battle, but they want to come back in the future. So Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab passes on, but the idea still remains, this idea of war against Muslims is still there. It's beneath the sands, so to speak. And then later on, before the First World War, at the end of the 19th century, Ibn Saud and al-Shaykh, these are the two, you can say, main power factions in Arabia. They came together once again to revive Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab's war against shirk, what he called shirk. Actually, it's a war against Muslims. And they consolidated themselves and they put together the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Because now they had finally, remember, I can't cover every year by year, but during this time, British colonialism had made its presence substantial in the Persian Gulf, in Egypt, in Iraq, in India. It was all around the place. And the British felt very comfortable with someone who has an Islamic argument, quote-unquote, an Islamic argument, who can initiate war against other Muslims, therefore causing Muslims to fight among themselves so that the British can carry on with their colonialist business, robbing the Muslims of their own resources. Remember, this was also at the time when petroleum was first discovered in that part of the world. So it obviously serves British and colonial interests, and thereafter American imperialist interests, to have a regime in Arabia that will justify internal Islamic wars that can keep the Muslims bleeding, therefore keep the Muslims off the colonialist and imperialist back. And this is what the Wahhabi Valala represents to the Muslims. I may want to also add that Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab's own father was against him, and his own brother, Sulaiman ibn Abd al-Wahhab, was also against him. He even wrote a book his own brother Sulaiman ibn Abdul Wahhab wrote a book to expose Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, his own brother's misguidance, deviation, and fallacies. So here we have Wahhabism that never, they have a history now that dates back from the 18th century. This guy, lived, Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, by the way, lived a long life. He died around, I think, 1792 or 93. So he was born 1702. He lived about 90 years. That's a long life. He didn't live up until the time when the French invaded, when Bonaparte came and invaded Egypt, and colonialism now was a more significant force. But the people who came after him, they lived obviously during those years of French and British colonialism in the area. But never have the Wahhabis fought against foreign occupiers. Never, since they ever came into existence. And so you can right now understand the comfortable relationship that the imperialists have with the government of Saudi Arabia, that says that it is the heir to Wahhabism. It is the inheritor, warith al-Wahhabiyya. It sits very well. You look at this from Washington, D.C., from London, and from Paris. There's a Saudi government there that looks at other Muslims, that has a religious establishment that considers other Muslims to be kafirs. I mean, what better than that? What else could you call for? What else do you want than something like that? In, of all geographies of the world, in the country of the Haramain, they consider all others who are not Wahhabis and Salafis to be kafirs. Not only Shiites. Some people are under the false impression that, oh, these people, they consider Shiites to be kafir. No, no, no. Relax. They consider all other Muslims who are not Salafis and Wahhabis to be kafirs. And this is very unfortunate that we have a regime like this. We just had, a few months ago, there was an attack on Gaza. All the world saw this. And there were some Muslim scholars who went to Saudi Arabia and said, you know, look, don't you think this is the time to come to support your Muslim brothers? And no, we're not going to support them. You can understand the rationale. If in their internal minds these are not Muslims, then yeah, they can easily say, we're not going to support them. Or, to pin them down even more, said, why don't you give some of your, because they have a lot of finance, they have a lot of money lodged all the way, everywhere around the world. You give some of this money to Muslims who are in need right now. He said, to Hamas. Hamas is the legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. It's been elected by the people in Gaza, and these elections were supervised by international personnel, monitors who went there to see that this is a fair and free election. And so Hamas comes to power. So what did this king, the same king that is in Arabia right now, what does he say to these Islamic scholars who spoke to him about this? He said, we will give our money to the Palestinian Authority, which is Mahmoud Abbas and his capitulationists. We will give it to them, but we won't give it to Hamas. To an average Muslim, this may not make sense. But the more you understand the Wahhabi psychology, then the more you will understand why they will withhold this support from those who are more Muslims, and they are more liberal at giving this support to those who are less Muslims, in the real sense of the word. The Wahhabis can easily say that they find no affinity with other Muslims, but they can find affinity with Christians. in their internal thoughts and mind, this is perfectly Islamic. Because these people who say that they are Muslims, they're not Muslims. Because they are guilty of shirk. You see, schools of thought to begin with, they don't validate schools of thought. They say there's no such thing as Hanafi school of thought, no such thing as Shafi'i school of thought, no such thing as Maliki school of thought. The Hanbalis, they have a problem with, they argue this back and forth because that's their man, and he has had historically a school of thought, so the argument around him becomes murky. But when it comes to al-madaris al-fiqhiyah, the Islamic schools of thought, they invalidate them. They say, no, there's no such thing. So, therefore, another Muslim who says, well, consider myself belonging to the Shafi'i school of thought, they come and say, well, you know, we're sorry if that's your case. We really don't consider you to be a Muslim. Okay. But when it comes to a Christian and a Jew, they say, well, these are Ahl Kitab. With all that they do, I mean, okay, a Muslim is not a Muslim because, let's say, in your opinion, he follows a certain school of thought, or he has some tashayyu' tendencies, or some tasawwuf tendencies, so in your eye, he's not a Muslim. But these people who have the cross and icons in their churches, and all of these bid'ahs and shirkiyat and everything you talk about, they are Ahl Kitab. I mean, can't you see? But the problem is, when you're speaking to these types of people, there's no mind to speak to. They've done away with rationality long time ago. So how are you going to make sense with them if they don't employ their own minds? So that explains to you why, for example, during the Lebanese Civil War, remember in the 1980s, there was a very serious war going on in Lebanon. And it turned into one that is basically Christian on one side and Muslim on the other side. And guess who were the Saudis were supporting? They're giving their money to the Christians. Because they said the Christians are Ahl Kitab, and these Muslims in Lebanon, they are guilty of shirk and kufr. Why should we be supporting them? You may not know this, there's a news item just a few days ago that the King Abdullah, invited a Jewish doctor from California. By the way, did anyone hear this news item? I'm curious. See, it doesn't make it around. They're protecting even the media, mainstream media, MSM, they're protecting them very well. This is what happened. In the past few weeks, there's a doctor who lives in California. I think it's in the Los Angeles area. He gets a notice saying that you have been nominated to receive a scholarly or scientific award from Saudi Arabia. This guy was surprised, obviously, but it was there, it was for real. He checked. Yeah, this is no fake, this is a real thing. So he takes his passports to the Saudi consulate in Los Angeles. And his passport, American passport, but it has Israeli, he's gone to Israel multiple times, has Israeli visas on it. And the Saudi Arabian government didn't have any problem issuing him a visa. He gave him a visa right there next to the Israeli visas on an American passport. This is the country that says, it's a government that says, oh, we are against Israel and all of this stuff. So, he flies over with his wife. His wife was born in Tel Aviv. She's Israeli by birth. She goes there. He takes, I don't know, he has three children, I don't know if he took one or three of them, but took part of his family or his whole family with him, and he is received by the king of Saudi Arabia. It wasn't like they had some committee, some scientific committee to take him. No, he was received like he was a hero of some sort. Red carpet reception, the whole honorary protocol that they receive official guests with. It was there. And they took him to the king with the translators and all. He said he was treated like royalty. So, and of course they gave him the cash. It was a cash prize, cash. No check, no, you know, cash. $200,000 for your contributions to medicine. Yes, I don't know what he contributed to medicine. I'm sure we have probably scores of Muslim doctors who have contributed the same thing. But in this Wahhabi mind, what we call a Muslim doctor is a mushrik doctor. So we're not going to give any money to him. Give it to some, you know, Ahl Kitab. Give it to some person who's Israeli and Zionist and all of this. And they get away with this. They get away with the last year when, you know, you've heard Muslims in Gaza wanted to go to Hajj. And they were not given the visas by the Saudi government to go to Hajj. This was before the massacre, before this Israeli war on Gaza. So no, you can't come. And they didn't come, no. It even took Ismail Haniyeh, who is the elected head of Gaza. He personally contacted the defense minister and the king himself and said, we have, I don't know, around 3,000 or so Muslims who want to go to Hajj. Please issue them the visa. And this is what he told them. He said, you will not be disappointed. Things will be all right. They'll be worked out. And so Ismail Haniyeh was under the impression they're going to issue the visas. Right? Someone tells you, oh, we're not going to disappoint you. We're going to work this out and things will be all right. So he's under pressure, okay, they're going to give him visas. Okay, he turns back and he tells his own people, inshallah, it's just a matter of a few days and everything will be all right. The visas are going to be issued and you'll be on your way to Hajj. It never happened. And you can understand, right now, with this mentality, if we are guilty of these shirkiyat, as they call it, the committing shirk crimes, if we Muslims are, in their judgment and in their perspective, if we are that type of people, then yeah, to them it's not a big deal not going to Hajj, massacring Muslims around the Kaaba. You know, you remember 1987, the Mecca massacre. Killed 400 people around the Kaaba. It's not a big deal. You can, even their own types, there are Salafis, who took issue with this Saudi Wahhabi crime, political crime. And you remember in 1979 when the Haram was taken over? What did the Saudis do? When they these are their own students. And they did something like that. They had no problems calling on Ahl al-Kitab. They called on the Germans and the French military to come into the Kaaba to cleanse these mushriks out of the Kaaba. These are their own students. But the French and the Europeans, these are Ahl al-Kitab. Not many people know that much of the finances in Saudi Arabia, managing the money flow in and out of that country, is done by Lebanese Christians. Lebanese Christians. Why? They are Ahl Kitab. In this warped Wahhabi understanding of things, they can trust Ahl Kitab. But they can't, they call imperialists and Zionists Ahl Kitab. But Muslims who are trying to be Muslims, whichever way they can, it's all right to treat them the way we're treating them. Bring them to Chop Chop Square that they have there. After Jumu'ah prayers, their execution is in one of the lots outside of the main masjid in Riyadh or in some other place. They bring Pakistanis, they bring Africans, they bring Bangladeshis, people from South Asia, and people from all across the African continent. If they steal something, you don't know why they stole it. Maybe they're in need or something. They say, open this up. You sold something that qualifies you to have your hand cut. We're going to take you out there and cut your hand, chop your hand off. And they do it. And the same thing is done for sexual offenses. Someone is caught in the act of having illicit sex, and they go and they execute the person. If he happens to be, quote-unquote, a Muslim, but he happens to be, quote-unquote, Ahl Kitab, no. Send them back. When was the last time you heard someone in that... they found some people who, in a court of law, could have been found guilty of these serious crimes. But the British government interfered, or the American government interfered, or any one of these quote-unquote Ahl Kitab governments interfered, and these people were, they may have been behind bars for some time, in jail, in prison, but they were set free. They were released. Nothing was done against them. This once again goes back to this very serious misunderstanding of Islam, out of which came this accusation of takfir. You know, the issue of takfir now is an issue that is disturbing Islamic societies. In Pakistan, you have some groups of people who look at other Muslims and say, oh, you're a kafir. This accusation of kufr, this what's called takfir, accusation of kufr, becomes very serious to the extent that Muslims now can justify going to war against each other because someone is saying you're a kafir. And we trace all of this back. It comes from a person like Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab and those who think along the same lines. And with the Israeli occupation of Palestine, with the Muslim world now witnessing the first chapters of its renewal, of its resumption, of its Islamic responsibilities and future, they need some. They need this type of takfiri, theological brainwashing inside Islamic populations to destabilize these populations. Therefore, you've heard in Iraq the issue of takfir that is used in India and Pakistan now. The same thing has gone over there. We have it moving in different parts of North Africa. And when you come and take a close look, where's all of this coming from? You inevitably wind up realizing that it has come from this Wahhabi distortion of Islam. They never take a look at the political and the military forces in the world. That never comes under their observation. Ask them, so what do you think about the Zionists who are occupying Palestine? Where do you put them in your Islamic vocabulary? What type of words? Do you have the word takfir that you can use against the Zionist? Or the word takfir that you can use against an imperialist? What happens? Why is this word absent when we're speaking about Zionism and we're speaking about imperialism? What do you say about that? They have nothing to say. because they're empty-minded. That's why when it comes, just take an example, when it comes to the issue of Hajj, the bara'a from the mushrikeen, they say this is a bid'ah, and it comes from people who are not Muslims. So we can't have a bara'a from the mushrikeen in the Hajj. Why? Didn't the Prophet have the bara'a from the mushrikeen in the Hajj? The mushrikun have gone away? There's no longer any mushriks in the world? And if there are mushriks in the world, it's the Muslims? If you press them on the issue, then who's the mushriks in the world? They're going to dig into their literature and in their... They say, yeah, well, we found out the mushriks in the world are the Muslims. Because that's exactly what exists in their books. So they tell me, is this not a godsend to the imperialists and the Zionists to have a theological, internal, Islamic school of thought that turns Muslims into mushriks and turns the imperialists and Zionists into Ahl Kitab? You can't ask for anything better from a Zionist imperialist perspective. That's a godsend. That's why they preserve, they protect. With all of this that's going on in the world, they don't want to say what's going on in Saudi Arabia. You see the Zionist imperialists, they're picking on Iran. When it comes to, for example, when it comes to issue of women's liberation, they say there should be women's liberation in Iran. But they don't say there should be women's liberation in Saudi Arabia. And when you take a look at the status of women in Saudi Arabia, under this Wahhabi regime, and you take a look at the status of women in Iran, women, I mean, if you're speaking about women as students, they're the majority of students now, and they tell you, in the universities. If you're looking at women, you know, pursuing their careers, they're out there, they're driving, they're in the bazaar, they're, no one's telling them you can't do whatever you have to do as a responsibility because you're a woman. No one says that. So where are these human rights organizations and where's the media and all of this when in Saudi Arabia a woman cannot drive a car? A woman has to be chauffeured. Imagine if a mother or a wife wants to go to the supermarket, she needs a chauffeur to take her in her own car to the supermarket. So what happened here? How conflicted can you be? The chauffeur is a man, and she's a woman, and they're in the same car. She can't drive her own car. But I mean, when you get into this mind, these are the types of conflicting interpretations that they have. They feel comfortable. You know, for someone else driving a car with their own wives or whoever is in the car, and for her to drive, no. And here you see the Western press not saying anything about it, as if this is normal. It doesn't bother them. It's very normal. Just like in India, not to get off the subject, but in India, the outcasts, the untouchables, who are about 200 million people, the press doesn't say anything about this. They can speak about, you know, Muslim women in India and Pakistan and how they are oppressed. But in India, you have, as a matter of history and as a matter of culture and as a matter of social norm, the permissibility of an upper caste person picking some of these girls. They have to offer them their bodies for the sexual gratification of the upper caste person. This is normal. And it's done in the probably tens of thousands as an everyday activity. No one's around to report on this. It's the same way they're protecting Saudi Arabia. And all of this is to try to assault the true Muslims who can identify the enemies of the Muslims and take them on. The Wahhabis, in their brief history of violent wars They killed Muslims who were unarmed, innocent. They tried to put together a military that fought against the Ottoman state. They have no compunctions about Muslims being massacred anywhere by other forces without them showing any interest in these other Muslims. And they seem to be getting away with this very comfortably simply because they have the money that they allocate to different organizations and Islamic organizations. I'm not talking about, you know, other seculars and all of this, which they pay also, but I'm talking about the Islamic organizations. And many Muslims keep silent about the crimes that this Saudi regime is getting away with. Some people have developed a mode of silence towards Saudi Arabia. I don't know why. I can't understand it. There might be some political trade-offs that are going on. Remain silent about the Saudis during these times and all of this. A munkar is a munkar. Saudi Arabia and its Wahhabi distortion of Islam is a munkar that has to be exposed. And it has to be exposed on the basis of Allah and His Prophet. And anytime, anywhere, Wahhabis in particular should be... Now, some people, they sort of want to speak in an emotional sense against the Wahhabis. I think emotions should be excluded from this area, and they should be presented with the record and with the facts and with the truth. No one here is trying to exaggerate anything or malign anything. We're trying to stick with the facts and the truth. They are condemned by what they said and they say, and they are condemned by what they did and by what they are doing today. All of that is enough to condemn them. I don't see any excuse for anyone remaining silent about this type of regime. In the past couple of weeks, the Saudi regime has been deporting Egyptians back to Egypt. And you ask them, why you're deporting these Egyptians back to Egypt? Say they are here illegally. How can you be in Al-Hijaz illegally? Has anyone just taken a moment to think about this? How can a Muslim be in Al-Hijaz, in Mecca or Medina illegally? Who said that? Where did that come from? What basis? You are the one who says you are Salafis. You go back to the Nas. You go back to the text, to the Book of Allah, to the Sahaba, to the Tabi'een, to the Tabi'een. Where did any of them say that it is illegal for a Muslim to be here? Where did you come up with that? But no one is taking a stand. With all of these crimes against Muslims, with all of these crimes against humanity that they have their hand in, not many people want to expose them. I still don't understand why. There should be an uproar against these Saudis, against these types. Recently, also in the past week, they passed a law in Saudi Arabia. They want to put cameras in internet cafes. وَلَا تَجَسَّسُوا. This is an area in which, you know, you may be on your file, just like you are in your home. This is a privacy. You're watching a person in his privacy, and you want to get away with that? It's not enough that you put these cameras in the haram, in the masajid that you think are going to go radical. You have your cameras in there. Now you're bringing them to the internet cafe. We're going to put them next time around. In people's homes? Where are you going with this? They get away with all of this. This should be public knowledge, public information. All Muslims should be speaking about the violation of the hurma, of the sanctity, of this common history and geography of the Muslims. Unfortunately, not many people are doing this. And because of that, the Saudi Wahhabi regime is getting away with, literally, it's getting away with genocide against innocent people. Of course, inside the Saudi Wahhabi structure, there are forces that are somehow amenable to some type of understanding, and there are others who are just actually the fanatical types. They don't want to hear anything from anyone. Their answer to anything is just to use, especially when it comes to Muslims, just to use force. They will hit, they will kill, they'll do whatever is necessary when it comes to Muslim. When it comes to anyone else, we haven't seen any action on their behalf. I hope somehow, in a sense, I've relayed to you what this aberration of Islam is in Arabia. I pray and I ask and I plead with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to cleanse Al-Hijaz from these corrupt rulers and to relieve the Muslims of these evil decision makers and to erase them and their regime from the face of the earth. When that day comes, it shall be a day of celebration for the Muslims and for the rest of humanity. Sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.